You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, January 15th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Rebecca is a little under the weather this evening. She says she lost her voice. There's definitely a winter bug going around, but hopefully she'll be able to join us next week. We are recording a day late this week because we had an extended interview with Michio Kaku last night, and we'll be playing some of that later in the show. And it turned out to be a little bit fortuitous because there was a very interesting news item today that we wouldn't have gotten to until next week if we hadn't delayed the show by a day. But before that, Evan, you have to tell us what's special about today.
Well, we have a couple things that are special about today. So we have a birth, we have a death, and we have an event. So we're going to celebrate the birth of Benjamin Franklin on January 17th.
Scientist and a gentleman.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Politician, diplomat, inventor.
Okay. Just, good people.
We don't know that, Jay. Nobody ever saw him. I mean, it's not like he took a $100 bill and, you know, rolled it
up. Yeah.
So, Ben Franklin, hero of mine, certainly. The death, yesterday, we lost Ricardo Montalban.
Oh,
Ricardo
yeah,
Montalban.
Con!
Exactly.
I got a random text from, you know, some strange number that just gave me the news item. And I actually felt bad about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's like we lost a villain that was very close to us.
I still remember him mostly as the Fantasy Island guy.
And the Chrysler guy. Sold Chrysler.
More than Con?
Yeah.
Corinthian leather. More than Con?
Yeah. Yes, Bob.
He is and forever will be Con. More than even O'Rourke.
I'll chase him round the outer nebula and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
You gotta amp that up about three notches, Evan, to even get close to Ricardo's portrayal of Khan.
Come on, the fact that I even know that line is something.
It was impressive.
I read a review that was funny. It said that only Ricardo could have chewed the scenery on par with William Shatner.
Wasn't that Phil Plait's review?
Was it?
Yeah.
It might have been.
He wrote that in his blog today. That, yeah. He did chew up the scenery. But it was great in that Star Trek campy way. I mean, that was awesome.
Total dork nerd trivia. What was the name of the episode on the
original? Space Seed.
Bob, let me finish the question.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, my God. You're such a loser.
What planet were they dropped off on?
SETI Alpha 5 or 4.
This is SETI Alpha 5. This is SETI Alpha 5, right?
What a good movie that was. That was a good movie.
What was the last thing, Evan?
On this very day, the elevator was patented in 1861 by Elijah Otis. Otis Elevators, anyone?
Captain Otis.
Yeah.
Made here in Connecticut nowadays. Headquartered here in Connecticut, so a little local flavor for the event of the day. And that's it.
Awesome.
I think I read somewhere that the elevator is the safest form of travel.
Statistically?
Yeah. But I think I also read the same thing for escalators. I don't know what to believe.
I got stuck in an elevator once.
I got stuck on an escalator once. That was terrible.
You're there for hours, right, Steve?
When's it going to start up?
Standing there.
Well, we have a very interesting news item today. Just announced today by NASA. Three words. Life on Mars. And I'm not talking about the new series. What NASA announced is that methane gas has been discovered on Mars. And that at first may not sound that impressive, but methane gas is one of the potential signs of life. Evan, you heard the actual press release or press conference this afternoon.
That's right. There was a panel discussion today that NASA conducted with five of the leading scientists who've been working on the Mars program. And, you know, basically what they had to tell us is that through their telescope observations, over 7 years worth of data that they compiled, they were able to find regions of active releases of methane gas. So the planet is alive. The question is it alive in a geological sense, or is it alive in a biological sense? That's the big question.
Now, the reason why methane is so interesting is that it is a very active
compound. It's a, you know, it's a carbon atom surrounded by four hydrogen atoms, and it reacts very much. That's why it's actually a good fuel. It's a very reactive compound. So it would not hang around in the atmosphere very long. Therefore, if you find methane in the atmosphere, something is making it or releasing it. It hasn't been hanging around in the atmosphere for a very long period of time. For as far as we know, there's only two sources of methane. Either it has to be released through geological activity, usually volcanic eruptions, but there could be other kinds of geological activity, I guess, that could release it. Or it's being produced by some microscopic life. Of course, that would be the far more interesting possibility.
How unbelievably awesome would that be?
Yeah, that would be incredible.
There's actually a third way, but they kind of shrugged off the third way because it was so unlikely.
Aliens? Farting aliens?
Comets. A large comet impact, which would have a large amount of methane that would have impacted the surface of Mars. But a couple things, they've pretty much ruled that out because it would have had to been very large, several kilometers, I guess, in length. And it would have had to happen very recently, like just a couple hundred years ago. And the recent surveys, all the mapping that they've been doing of Mars would have definitely revealed some kind of comet impact.
Right.
And they would have considered that. So they've pretty much brushed that aside. One of the interesting things, Steve, you mentioned volcanoes and the release of methane. What they're also looking for are other trace gases that go along with that. Like when a volcano erupts, it also, for instance, releases sulfur dioxide. And they're not getting any traces of sulfur dioxide in the trace gas readings. So that's one kind of tick in the direction of it being biological as opposed to geological.
Plus, there isn't really any evidence right now that Mars is geologically active.
There are very few active fault lines, right? There's no earthquakes occurring, breaking up the crust of the surface to release the gases and so forth.
Isn't the Mars crust is completely solidified, right? There are no faults.
That's right. There are no faults.
But how deep, though? I don't know if we have a sense of how, you know, how deep that, that is true. At some point, you might find some faulting down below or vents or some hydrothermal vents or something. But also, I've come across news reports from a few years ago where they actually discussed this, and there was a couple scientists that were saying that, well, there are other ways. You don't just need volcanism or anything like that. One of them would be to actually have the carbon dioxide in the water coming in contact with a mineral olivine, which is very abundant on Mars, and they said that could produce the methane. And nobody mentioned that in the panel today. But I believe there's multiple different ways to do it. It's not just either volcanism or biological life. There's other ways for this to happen. And I found this story, to be frank, disappointing. I mean, I saw the news item. Our friend Jack sent an email saying that, like something like, holy crap, life on Mars. So, of course, I got excited. Then I read a bunch of websites, saw the people talking about it. And it's really like you're flipping a coin almost. There's really not much to go on either side that really points to one or the other. Maybe a couple little things, like Evan said, the sulfur dioxide might be one tick in one direction. But I was disappointed, and it could be years before they really nail this down. So I was like, oh, here we go.
They're going to have to send a rover.
Well, they're going to send another mission up there. They're going to send something called the MSL, or the Mars Science Lab.
Yeah, like what, 6 years, 7 years?
I thought there was going to be a mission by 2011.
The Mars Science Laboratory is going to launch in 2011, and of course it'll take time to get to Mars from there. You're right, Bob, but having methane in the atmosphere is better than not having methane in the atmosphere of Mars. It at least opens the door for microbial life, subsurface life, as one of the possible causes of that methane. And while there are other possible sources of methane, there's nothing really going very strongly for those other possibilities. They certainly could be true, but it's not as if there is a leading contender that's much more likely than existing microbial life on Mars. So it at least opens the door.
Imagine if they freaking found bacteria on Mars, how incredible would that be?
Well, you think about it, either it would be related to life on Earth or it wouldn't be related to life on Earth. And both of those possibilities are incredibly fascinating and awesome. If it's related to life on Earth, then the question is, well, how closely related is it? How similar is it if it has something similar to RNA or DNA. It has similarities in the genetic code, which sequence of base pairs equals which amino acids. But it's different, and maybe it's more different from the majority of life on Earth than, say, mitochondrial DNA is from cellular DNA. Or then you can get some notion or some idea of like how far in the past life on Earth split off from life on Mars. And, of course, that would mean that one planet seeded the other.
Or Steve, it comes, you know, we both were seeded from a different solar system.
Yes, or both were seeded from another source. Maybe they were something like bacteria in dormancy, frozen inside chunks of ice that became part of our, you know, the cloud that formed our solar system and rained down on all the planets in the solar system, and on Mars and on the Earth, it took root. Of course, if life on Mars is not related to life on Earth, then I don't know. That may even be more fascinating, because now we have evidence of a second origin of life. So now we know it could happen. It wasn't just an unbelievable fluke that it happened on Earth. It happened. That would mean that it probably would happen anywhere it can happen. You know, if it happened on Earth and on Mars.
What does that do to the Drake equation? Do we see a spike in the probability or the number of?
As we discussed previously, the Drake equation, which is all of the variables that you would need to know in order to estimate how common life is, and specifically radio-emitting technologies are in the universe. That's just one of that long string of variables, but it certainly would increase that one variable. Just, you know, how common is it for life itself to form? Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, imagine the boon to science to have a completely separate biological system independently evolved to examine, you know, a completely different biochemistry and experiment of life. That would unbelievable, unimaginable.
Incredible.
It's off the charts, really.
Yeah, It would be the scientific find of
all time.
Of all time. In my opinion. Absolutely.
Top three, at least.
And it comes darn close to my prediction. I didn't quite get it, because I predicted early in 2008. I said they'll definitively say that they found some kind of life on Mars. But I didn't quite make it.
It's true, but if you were a psychic, you would be calling that a hit.
Oh, definitely. I'd be playing that up. I'd be raking in the cash. You know
it. Sure. So we'll keep you updated on that. If anything else comes out over the next week or so, we'll talk about it more next week. But that's cool. And I hope that leads to more, sooner, better missions to Mars, specifically designed to search for the sort of subsurface microbes that could be producing that methane.
And Europa. Let's go to Europa, too, while we're at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Darn straight.
There's another NASA news item, this one from earlier in the week, about solar storms.
With a new study that came out from National Academy of Sciences says that we're due. We are due for a major solar storm that could hit as soon as maybe 2012. And
2012, it's the Mayan calendar. That's what
I
it is.
Know. Isn't that amazing? It's just a fascinating
coincidence.
Fascinating. Yeah, no. Could it be? Is it really a coincidence?
I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood you. Did you say we're due for a big one in 2012?
They're saying that's approximately, I guess, the year that it definitely could happen.
Well, and to be clear, that is simply the next time that we will probably get a peak in solar activity, around 2012.
Right.
And these solar storms happen more often, and they are more powerful during peaks in solar activity. But the kind of storm that they were talking about is not the kind that happens routinely whenever we have a solar maximum. The last such storm occurred in 1859.
Yep, 1859.
Yeah, so
which
that's about 150 years ago.
Yeah, very dangerous. And so these space storms, they're created when the sun erupts, and they send these charged particles that obviously come out in a bubble, in a hot gas called plasma. And back in 1859... this bubble took, they estimate, about 17 hours to go from the sun to the Earth, and whereas solar storms typically take as much as 4 days to actually reach from the sun to us. So this is an intense, fast, basically punch that the Earth is going to have to take in. They measure these space storms in nanoteslas. You ever heard that term before, Bob?
I forget, maybe.
Just the word nano, you know, I obviously
I've heard.
Think of you.
Right.
So it's actually a negative number, and they say a moderate storm is around negative 100 nanoteslas. The 1859 storm was negative 1,760 nanoteslas, and it was enough to short out the telegraph system that was, you know, just recently invented in the United States. And
what the storm does is induce currents in the lines, and there was actually lots of fires. It caused lots of fires, and because technology was so primitive then, that nobody really even noticed, really, besides, unless you were near the fire.
That's right, right, unless you were near the fire. But today, a pulse like that or a bubble like that, I mean, could really send us into a mini dark age of sorts.
Well, it could wipe out a lot of our communication satellites. Global positioning, weather forecasting, a lot of the satellites could, again, the currents that get induced would fry the electronics. Even ones that are, you know, hardened to survive some of the less violent solar storms may not be able to stand up to a major one like the one that hit 150 years ago.
Now, does it only hit the side of the Earth that's facing the sun at that time?
That's a good question. So how big is it? So how long would it take to pass over the Earth? But you remember, if you're thinking about satellites, you know, a satellite would have to be in the shadow of the Earth from the sun, I guess, not to be hit by it. Would it have more of a field effect where it would sort of go around corners, or would it be more of just...
They describe it as a bubble, so I think it would envelop the Earth.
Yeah.
It's kind of how... It is my take on it, but I didn't read anything on that specifically about which direction the Earth is facing.
And so, would they be sort of refracted by the atmosphere at all? And so I don't know if satellites, even in the shadow of the Earth, would be protected.
What does it do to our magnetosphere? And don't forget, though, that this one we're talking about, this huge one from 1859, it was described as a perfect storm because so many elements came into play that made it so nasty. And one of the key ones was actually the orientation of the magnetosphere was perfectly aligned to cause all this damage. If it was oriented in another way, it would have lessened it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you imagine what the Northern Lights would look like?
They saw them down in Rome and in Hawaii back in 1859. Imagine that in Hawaii and Rome.
That's going to happen eventually. I mean, it's just a matter of time.
It's like an asteroid.
Yeah. And this is the kind of thing that does happen on the order of magnitudes of a couple hundred years. You know, these kind of storms happen, not hundreds of thousands of years. So we'll see it in the next 100 years or so.
There's nothing we can do about it.
If you unplugged your electronics, would they be safer, or is it just going to, like...
I think they might be a little safer, but I think if it's going to induce a current, whether it's off or not, I think there are ways to harden it, but man, it would cost a lot of money, and it would make the satellites heavier, and that's, you know, that's millions of dollars just for that. But they've got to start thinking about that, because the downside is just too nasty.
Right, there would be at the very least a critical, like a backup, you know, a core of satellites that are hardened against that, so that they wouldn't go down. They could at least take over somewhat for the communications network, even if a lot of the other commercial satellites go out. But they also mentioned that this could shut down the power grid, not just satellites in communication, but actually might take down the power grid.
Well, if that's true, then now we're talking about an end game.
Well, it certainly would affect several tens, if not hundreds of millions of people on the Earth.
Yeah, they said they estimate it might cut power to 130 people in the United States.
130 million.
130 million people in the United States. Yeah, that's like half the population. Right. And certainly the initial effects would be catastrophic. I don't know that it would end civilization. Again, it's one of those things where you won't really know what it would be like until it happens and we see how people respond and what infrastructure there is to sort of... to keep things going while repairs are made. They did estimate it would take months to repair the power grid. So yeah, that would certainly be a lifestyle change, having to go months without power.
How would we do this podcast?
Yeah, that's true. It's a good point, Evan.
Oh my gosh, this is worse than I thought.
The SGU would go dark for months. What we have to do is record about 20 episodes. Record them and have them ready to go.
Or we take it as a live act on the road, like vaudeville.
Yeah, we might have to do that.
That would be good.
A few pies in the face. Mm-hmm.
Bob, you sent me a story about some new MRI technology.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. IBM and Stanford University have created an Uber MRI machine with, get this, 100 million times the resolution of conventional MRI. It's like eight orders of magnitude. How sweet is that? This lets them image the nanoscale biological objects at the nanoscale for the first time using this MRI type of imaging. It's called not MRI, but it's MRFM, which stands for magnetic resonance force microscopy. Basically, what this thing does is it detects extremely minute magnetic forces. And let me try to give you just a quick overview of exactly how this thing works. They take a biological sample, like viruses or proteins or whatever, and you place it on this tiny, tiny, really vanishingly small sliver of silver that's kind of shaped like a diving board. You put this at the diving board end of this, and this is called a cantilever. And the other side of this apparatus, you have a nanoscopic magnetic tip. And so each of the nuclei in the sample act like tiny Barg magnets, which can be manipulated to attract and then repel, alternatively, the magnetic tip, which then, of course, causes the cantilever to vibrate because the sample is attached to the cantilever. So you've got this cantilever that's vibrating back and forth, and these vibrations are then analyzed to create this incredible 3D image. This is just one of the key advancements for this technology. Scanning electron microscopes can get down to the nanometer realm, but they can't create these 3D images, nor can they examine the internal structures, which is another one of the key advances that they made here. And the benefits, of course, now just use your imagination with an MRI like this, the benefits can be extraordinary. Dan Ruger, he manages the nanoscale studies at IBM's Almaden Research Center. He says that if we achieve our ultimate goal of atomic resolution, it could have tremendous impact on medicine and drug design. In fact, if this is used to study the structure of proteins and the ways they interact, that could truly be revolutionary improvements in drug design, personalized healthcare, and targeted medicines. And from my point of view, this would also be, you know, beyond that, if you're able to examine minute, complex 3D structures, the impact on nanotechnology and integrated circuit design could also be huge. But there's one caveat. There's one thing that's kind of confusing. People see MRI, they think, oh, wow, it's a conventional MRI scanner. But it's not a conventional MRI scanner. This is an MRFM. It's really completely different. It's not intended for a hospital setting. You're not going to get sit in a tube in the hospital and have your nanobits examined by this device.
Yeah, this really isn't something that would have clinical applications. This is more for manufacturing and research. You know, right. In terms of MRIs clinically, the resolution at the moment is already very, very good. I'm not sure there would be much to gain by a significantly higher resolution than what we already have. If you want to make a conventional MRI scan better, actually making it faster would be much more of an advantage than increasing the resolution. The reason for that is the thing that degrades the quality of MRI images the most is patients moving while they're in the MRI scan. You have to keep very, very still, and any movements sort of blur the image a little bit. The faster you take the images, that reduces the movement artifact. And if you can get to, you know, extremely fast image taking, then you could do things like image parts of the body that move, like the heart, you know. Also, what's interesting is that MRIs at the present time almost have too much resolution in that they see lots of little ditzels that don't really have a lot of clinical meaning. In fact, we often call them UBOs. What do you think that stands for?
Unidentified
bright object. Like there's little bright spots on the MRI scan. Nobody knows, you know, often we don't know what they are. You know, they could be nothing. They're just you're starting to get down to such resolution that there's just a lot of noise in the MRI scan. So more resolution wouldn't necessarily be a better thing. Well, let's go on to an email. We're going to leave a lot of time this week for the Michio Kaku interview. We do have time for one email. This one comes from Robert Mangus from the USA. Sorry if I didn't pronounce that name correctly. And he writes, I am a young skeptic in ninth grade. I am new to skepticism and would really appreciate general advice or knowledge you could impart on me. My dad is a practicing physician, so I am familiar with the scientific method and all that jazz. As a younger person, I find it really hard to be taken seriously by older people when I try to identify myself as a skeptic. Do you have any advice for all the young skeptics of the world? Sincerely, Robert. That's a very good question. I tell you, to a certain degree, it doesn't get better because my father still pulls that crap on me. Yeah. He does. You know, he still tries to pull the, I'm your father, I'm older than you, and I know better than you. And when you get to be my age, you'll see that I was right all along. So I think that to that extent, you just have to suck that up. That doesn't necessarily ever go away.
Yeah, but he's been saying that since he was your age.
That's right. That's right. Right. It's like, Dad, I am your age now. It's especially funny when, you know, it's like about a medical topic. You know, sometimes I whip out the sarcasm. It's like, gee, you know, I might have learned something about that in medical school. But your parents can't see you that way. You know, they're not going to see you. I don't know. At least my parents, they kind of always see you as your child. That's the relationship, and to an extent, it doesn't necessarily change. But you know, I think that it's, first of all, it's sometimes challenging to be taken seriously as a skeptic at any age, you know, by someone who is not amenable to that philosophy. But you have to develop a thick skin. You have to be used to the fact that whenever you express strong opinions or opinions which may rub people the wrong way, that you know, the response is often to try to take you down a peg or to create the impression that your opinions are not valuable or worthwhile. And if you're young, that's the cheap shot, right? That's the easy one to go for. It's like, well, I could dismiss you because you're young. So I think that you're just going to have to deal with a certain amount of that. My advice is don't let it get to you.
Right.
It's an argument from authority, really. It's ageism to an extent. Don't let it make you shy away from expressing your opinion. If you could defend yourself, if you could defend your opinion, stick to the logic, stick to the facts, state your opinion, and those people who are going to be open to that will give you and your opinions the respect that it deserves. If someone's going to dismiss you because you're young, then they probably would dismiss you for some other reason if they don't like your opinion. You know what I mean? So again, that problem that you're facing, whereas, yeah, I think it's a little bit more challenging the younger you are. It doesn't really ever go away. It just turns into other things.
I've learned that you're far better off not coming off aggressively because you're going to immediately put people on the defense, and it'll just be better if you have a tone about what you're saying where you're expressing your opinion and you're passing information along and you're not telling them what to think. And one thing we've mentioned on the show in the past is that you will do better if you look at it more like you're nudging people over time. You're pushing them in the right direction over time, and you're not trying to recast the way they think at that moment. Just give them
planting a seed.
Yeah, give them something to think about and then continue to do it.
So in a way, you have to take the longer view, I think, in order to weather those situations. Don't feel like you need to go in with your fist flying metaphorically and that you have to come out of each encounter victorious or the other person admitting that you're correct. And again, that holds true no matter how old you get. Most people are not going to, you know, be able to step back and acknowledge defeat. And also, of course, don't forget to consider the fact that you might be the person who's wrong, right? And in fact, in any kind of disagreement or discussion where people have different opinions, your first order of business should be to figure out if there's anything wrong with your position. Are you committing any logical fallacies? Are you neglecting to account for certain facts that maybe you weren't aware of? Have you forgot to consider certain alternatives? So your goal should be to examine your own position first and then to try to find common ground. That's a very effective strategy. What do you both believe in, and then start from there and try to see how far you can get with the common ground and to identify those things that are the source of your disagreements. And again, that strategy works well at any age, but I think it may deflect a lot of the dismissiveness that you're encountering. Well, let's go on to our interview. We are joined now by Professor Michio Kaku. Dr. Kaku, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Glad to be on your show.
And Professor Kaku is
the Henry Samat Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College of New York and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is the author of many popular science books on physics, including Visions, Hyperspace, Parallel Worlds, Beyond Einstein, and his latest book, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks, The Physics of the Impossible, which we understand is going to be made into or serialized on the Science Channel. We greatly appreciate you being on our show. We have discussed almost all of the things that you like to write about or things that we like to chat about on this show. But first, let me start by just asking you why you got involved with popularizing science as much as you have.
Well, when I was a child of eight, everyone was talking about the fact in my school that a great scientist had just died. Everyone was talking about it. It was the number one news story. That person was Albert Einstein. And they flashed a picture of his desk on the wire services. And I noticed the caption was very strange. The caption said, "This is the unfinished manuscript of the greatest scientist of our era." I didn't know who this man was. I didn't know what he was doing. But I just knew that it was unfinished. And I thought to myself, wow, wouldn't it be great to help finish this unfinished manuscript? But every time I went to the library, there was nothing, literally nothing on the work of this great man. Either they just trivialized the work, saying that his work led to the atomic bomb, or they didn't mention it at all. And I said to myself, when I become a professor of theoretical physics, I want to write books that I would have liked to have read when I was a kid, because I knew there was good stuff out there. I knew that physics was going to be fantastic. I knew there were going to be all source of mind-blowing concepts to be learned, but there was nothing, absolutely nothing in the library. Well, today I'm a physicist. I work on string theory, which we think is the fabled theory that Einstein missed for the last 30 years of his life. And so I want to impart the same enthusiasm, the same wonderment that I felt as a child confronting the theory of everything.
Reading a lot of what you've written and watching your interviews, I was struck that you do bring up the theme of Albert Einstein often. Do you feel that you, and to some degree, you have modeled your career after him?
Oh, definitely. My parents were very poor when I was growing up. It was obvious to me. In fact, my parents were locked up in a relocation camp in California during World War II. So after the war, I realized that if I was going to do anything, I would have to do it myself. I was not going to be given a silver spoon, and I would have to find a role model. And Albert Einstein was my role model as a child. So it was no mystery to me how to become a professor of theoretical physics. By studying his career path, I knew exactly at what age I had to accomplish certain goals and certain milestones. So it really helped me, because now I see kids emailing me, and they're in the same situation. There's nobody that could tell them what the career path for a theoretical physicist is. They have no idea what courses to take. They have no idea what milestones they have to reach, how to become a professor of theoretical physics. They email me. And for me, it was easy, because all I did was I understood Einstein's career path. So I owe a very big debt to him.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it's fair to say that your goal is to become the Albert Einstein of the 21st century?
Well, every physicist dreams that one day perhaps we can finish a piece of this gigantic tapestry that is unfolding called the laws of physics. Everyone hopes that we can make a lasting contribution. And I'm the co-founder of string field theory, one of the main branches of string theory. And the promise of string field theory is that it allows you to summarize all of string theory into an equation just 1 inch long. That's my equation. That's the equation of string field theory. However, that's not enough. Now we have something called M-theory, membrane theory, a theory that's even more advanced than string theory, though it's identical to string theory. And the fundamental equations of M-theory are totally unknown again. So we physicists are being thrown out into the wilderness once again. And so that's what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to write down the field equations for M-theory. That's what I'm currently doing in my research.
Professor, could you give our audience a quick overview of string theory and M-theory?
Okay, very quickly. We physicists, when we smash protons, we find more particles coming out. We give them all sorts of bizarre Greek-sounding names. We have pi meson, kappa particles, mu mesons, Yang-Mills particles, gluons. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of subatomic particles coming out of our atom smashes. In fact, G. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb, was so frustrated that we were drowning in this ocean of subatomic particles that he made the formal announcement that the Nobel Prize in physics should go to the physicist who does not discover a new particle that year. In string theory, we think that if you could peer into the heart of an electron, you wouldn't see a blob. You would see a rubber band. And the rubber band, it vibrates at different frequencies, and if you twang it, it turns into another particle, a neutrino. You twang it again, it turns into a quark. You twang it again, it turns into a Yang-Mills particle. And if you hit it enough times, you should get all the subatomic particles that we see in Mother Nature. So we have a very simple, elegant picture by which we can summarize the enormous diversity of subatomic particles. So at first we thought, wow, this is a great idea, a very simple paradigm that magically absorbs all of Einstein's theory, all of quantum theory. Einstein's theory, by the way, is just the lowest vibration of the string. If Einstein had never been born, in some sense, we would have discovered his entire theory as nothing but the lowest harmonic of superstring theory. But now we have this zinger coming at us. We now realize that string theory can coexist with membranes as well. In fact, our universe may be one of the membranes predicted by this theory. So this theory in the last decade or so has made enormous philosophical changes in our thinking about the cosmos. We no longer talk about a universe anymore. If you work in string theory, we talk about a multiverse of universes. That if our universe is a bubble, a membrane, floating in hyperspace, then there could be other bubbles out there, other membranes. And perhaps these membranes can collide, perhaps they can fission, perhaps they can peel off just like soap bubbles can. And so we have a bubble bath. So the new paradigm is a bubble bath where we have these little soap bubbles called universes floating in a much larger ocean of 11-dimensional hyperspace.
So a couple of clarifications for me. Does string theory require M-theory, or is it just something, one of the possible things that emerges from it?
Well, they're the same thing. You see, string theory was discovered quite by accident back in 1968. We were not really meant to see this theory for maybe 100 years. It is so bizarre, it is so crazy, that even the mathematicians have been shocked. Whole branches of mathematics have emerged out of string theory, believe it or not. But because it's evolving backwards, we're still unveiling new layers of complexity. And we now realize that string theory has yet another layer of complexity, which is called M-theory. It's the same theory, except it allows you to summarize a theory in a much more concise and cohesive way.
Isn't it true that there were four or five separate string theories, and M-theory kind of like subsumes all of them into one overarching theory, well, as far as it can go?
That's right. If you want to summarize all of string theory into just a handful of equations, you can use my formalism, string field theory. You write down five equations, and that summarizes all of string theory. But why should there be five different strings? You know, you want one string, right? It turns out that if you go to the 11th dimension, one dimension higher than string theory, and you look down from the mountaintop, then you see all five string theories as unified. So if you take a look at string theory, why do we have five different string theories? Because if you take an 11-dimensional beach ball and you compress one dimension, there are five ways you can compress one dimension in 11 dimensions to get 10 dimensions. So looking down from the mountaintop, looking down from the 11th dimension, down to the 10th dimension, down to the valley, you immediately see why there are five different string theories.
M theory is the unification of these various forms of
string theory,
and it sounds like the part of the way that was accomplished was by adding a dimension to going to another dimension.
It was again discovered by accident. All these great breakthroughs are discovered by very smart people making guesses and basically accidents. We began to realize that there were relationships between the five different string theories, And that if you go to the 11th dimension, you can summarize all five of them in terms of one basic theory. So it's a beautiful, gorgeous way to see how simplicity emerges out of the complexity of thousands and thousands of subatomic particles.
When you can't mention string theory, of course, without bringing up the fact that there are those who say that although it may be a beautiful and elegant theory within the realm of theoretical physics, that no one has yet come up with a way to test it to see if it actually is describing our universe. I've heard you give answers to that, but why don't you tell us what you think about that criticism?
Yeah, because I think the criticism is pretty silly. All good theories eventually get tested, and there are four or five ongoing experiments that will test the periphery and the heart of string theory. First of all, we have the Large Hadron Collider. And we hope to find not just Higgs bosons with the Large Hadron Collider, but also sparticles. Sparticles are superparticles. They represent like the next set of vibrations of the string. We represent the lowest octave. Everything you see around you is strings vibrating in the lowest octave. But the string has many octaves, higher octaves, and one of them looks just like dark matter. In fact, we think dark matter is nothing but just the next vibration of the string. So these are called particles, superparticles, higher excitations of the string that we don't see in ordinary life. We saw them at the Big Bang, but that's what the Large Hadron Collider is all about, to recreate the Big Bang. So we want to recreate particles. The only particle left today is dark matter, we think. So that's the first set of experiments, to look for particles from the Large Hadron Collider and perhaps dark matter.
String theory specifically predicts that that sparticles will be produced in the Large Hadron Collider, and that would distinguish it from other formulations of unification or of particle physics?
Well, the Large Hadron Collider is a small machine, believe it or not. It may not be big enough to create sparticles. Now, the Super Collider, the granddaddy of all machines, was to be built outside Dallas, Texas. But the United States Congress, in its wisdom, gave us $1 billion to dig the hole for the Super Collider. Then they canceled it in 1993. And then Congress gave us a second $1 billion to fill up the hole. $2 billion to dig a hole and fill it up. I can't think of anything more stupid than the United States Congress giving us authorization to dig a hole, canceling, and then giving us a second $1 billion to fill it up. Now, the Super Collider might have been much more advantageous in terms of producing sparticles. However, the Large Hadron Collider is a much smaller machine. And as a consequence, some of us are a little bit afraid that it might not be big enough, might not be powerful enough to recreate the conditions of the Big Bang, where sparticles dominated the Big Bang. But we'll see. You know, we can only cross our fingers and hope. Anyway, there are many tests of string theory. The next set of tests of string theory you can actually do in your living room. And this is the test for deviations from Newton's inverse square law. When we're in grade school, we learn that gravity diminishes the farther away you go from a planet. In fact, it diminishes as the inverse square. Now, why? Because we live in a three-dimensional world. The skin of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. Therefore, the area of a sphere grows as the square of the distance. Therefore, if you go away from a light bulb, the intensity of light from a light bulb goes down as the inverse square, because we live in three dimensions. If we lived in four dimensions, light would diminish as the inverse cube. If we lived in n dimensions, it would go down as the inverse n minus one. So therefore, at small distances, we should look for tiny deviations from Newton's laws of gravity. Now, we know that Newton's laws of gravity work for the Pioneer space probe, the Voyager space probe, the Viking on Mars. We use Newton's laws of motion every day for our space probe. But we don't use Newton's laws of motion in your living room. That's what we want to do. We want to test for tiny, tiny deviations from the inverse square law in your living room. And if we could find it, it would mean that the universe is not really three-dimensional, that at tiny distances, maybe the fourth dimension begins to open up. There's other sets of experiments, dark matter experiments. Mm-hmm. We want to capture dark matter in a bottle. We now know that dark matter overwhelms ordinary matter by about a factor of 10. Every single textbook in chemistry on the planet Earth is wrong when it says that the world is mainly made out of atoms. We now know that the world is not mainly made out of atoms. You and me, the higher elements, make up 0.03% of the universe. hydrogen and helium that make up the stars make up 4% of the universe, and then dark matter makes up 23% of the universe, and then dark energy makes up 73% of the universe. And so if dark matter is everywhere, we want to be able to capture it in a bottle. And that's what several groups are doing right now. They have these gigantic vats of hydrogen-containing fluid. They have cameras looking for a tiny spark. That spark is caused when dark matter collides with a proton and smashes the proton, creating a spark. So far, we haven't found anything yet, but any day now, any day, any year, any decade, somebody may announce that we've captured dark matter in a bottle. And the leading candidate for dark matter is the sparticle, a superparticle. And again, that's another set of experiments. Yet another set of experiments is in outer space. LISA is the largest satellite experiment ever conducted in outer space. It's to be launched in the next decade. It is called the Laser Interferometry Space Antenna. It is three satellites making a triangle in outer space. The triangle is 3 million miles across.
It's a big triangle.
Many times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. If vibrations from the Big Bang, still circulating around the universe, hit this triangle, it'll jiggle it. We will pick up the vibrations, and we will have, quote, baby pictures from the instant of creation.
Would that be gravity waves?
That's right. This is a gravity wave detector. It'll detect radiation emitted within about a trillionth of a second from the instant of the Big Bang. And we should be able to pick up radiation from the pre-Big Bang universe. Many of my friends work on the pre-Big Bang universe. This is one of the hottest topics in string theory right now. Each pre-Big Bang theory gives us a certain kind of radiation. We can test that against the radiation found by LISA. So LISA detects radiation emitted right after the Big Bang, but you can run the videotape backwards. And when you run the videotape backwards past the Big Bang, you can now use string theory, which is a finite theory, to make predictions about what the pre-Big Bang universe was. Some of the betting is that it's the collision of two membranes that gave us the Big Bang. That's called the Big Splat theory. Other people think that it's the budding or the sprouting of a baby universe that created the Big Bang. So that is another way we can then start to test string theory. So the people who say that string theory cannot be tested don't know what they're talking about. The final way to test string theory, which is what my strategy is that by pure mathematics, by the power of the human mind, forget all the atom smashers that cost billions and billions of dollars, the human mind should be able to crack string theory. In which case, any day, some young, enterprising, bright physicist may say, "Eureka! I have found the true solution of string theory, and I can calculate the mass of the proton."
So, yeah, so if your solution to the string theory shakes out the standard model of particle physics, that would be a pretty significant confirmation that you're on the right track.
However, there is a valid criticism of string theory. The criticism is that it has too many solutions. Now, take a look at Maxwell's equations for light. We know the equations for light. They're called Maxwell's equations. How many solutions of Maxwell's equations are there? Well, infinite. You can have lasers, you can have light bulbs, you can have toys, you can have all sorts of electrical devices, right? Each one a solution of Maxwell's equations. Now, let's say I give you a theory of the universe. Let's say I give you an equation which describes the entire universe, the theory of everything. How many solutions are there? Well, it depends on the initial conditions, right? How many solutions of Maxwell's equations are? Well, you got to tell me, is it a laser beam? Is it a blinking light? Is it a traffic light? What are you solving, right? That's what we don't know. We don't know the initial conditions of the universe. As a consequence, if string theory has many, many solutions, that's typical. That's very typical. But it's also frustrating, because since we don't know what the initial conditions were, it's hard to have predictive value coming out of the theory.
Wouldn't it be too chaotic? You could never even in principle know the exact starting condition. Therefore, you could never predict beyond a short period of time. Just some, you know, standard chaos theory. Would that apply in this case?
Well, there's several philosophies. One philosophy being pushed is called the landscape theory. Landscape theory simply says if I have a rolling plain, a landscape, and there are many, many hills, many valleys, each one representing a valid solution, and, you know, let a million universes blossom, let them all coexist, and we just live in that one universe that is compatible with life. Life is very difficult to get off the ground. The nuclear force has to be tuned just right to get stable protons. Gravity has to be tuned just right in order to get universes that don't blow up or have a big freeze. So maybe our universe is just one dot on this landscape of universes. That's one approach. The approach that I like to take, though, is different. My philosophy is that the theory is not in its final form. It was discovered by accident in 1968. We were, in some sense, not meant to see it. For several more decades, the normal progression of physics would not have led to the discovery of string theory for another 50 years. So maybe it's not in its final form. We now have M theory. Nobody has the equations for M theory. The only thing we know about M theory is that it reduces down to string theory in 10 dimensions. The 11-dimensional theory, nobody knows, period. Okay? Given that fact, I think it's a little bit premature to make direct comparisons to experiment. Because I think the theory is not in its final form, and we don't know its true solution. We don't know the true initial conditions of the Big Bang as a consequence. But that's my philosophy.
Right. So you're saying that if I get abducted by aliens, I should ask them for the equation, the final equation to M theory, and that would be a pretty good proof that they were extraterrestrial.
Well, yeah, they would definitely know something that no human being on the planet Earth knows. However, the notation, right. They use a different notation than us. So we may have to translate some of their mathematics into our primitive math.
They might call it N theory.
Can you elaborate on the relationship between string theory and the multi-universe model?
It depends on ordinary quantum mechanics. You don't have to have string theory for this. Ordinary quantum mechanics has the famous Schrodinger-Cant paradox. This is the greatest paradox in all of science. It is much greater than all the paradoxes you read about in English class or whatever. The Schrodinger-Cant paradox is the greatest paradox ever conceived of by the human mind. And the paradox boils down to the question, is a cat dead or alive? Until you look at it, the cat is neither dead nor alive. So in quantum mechanics, we're used to the fact that we deal with objects that are neither here nor there, but the sum of the two. Now, that may sound like we're a candidate for the Looney Farm, but that is the foundation for the world economy. The world economy is based on the internet, laser beams, EVOMs, stuff like that. All of that is based upon the fact that electrons can be two places at the same time. Now, when you took chemistry class in high school, and your teacher asked you to draw the atom, you drew a football, the 1s orbital, the 2s. Remember that in high school? You had to draw all these orbitals. Well, they didn't tell you what the orbital was. What is this football? Your teacher may have mumbled and said, it's like an electron smeared out over a football. Wrong. The electron is a point particle. How can you smear a point particle? That football represents the electron being many places at the same time. We didn't tell you that because it would have upset you in high school. You would have thought your high school teacher was nuts. Quantum mechanics is based upon the fact that electrons can be many places at the same time. For all intents and purposes, the electron is a point particle. It may be a string inside that point, but it looks like a point particle. And it's smeared out only because the electron is many places simultaneously. The point is that if I have a cat in a box, there are two ways to explain the state of the cat before you look at it. One way was the way of Bohr, who said that atoms are different from people, that atoms can exist many places at the same time, but people cannot. Therefore, there's a brick wall, a wall, he said, separating the microcosmic world where electrons are many places simultaneously, and us. We live in a definite state. Well, we don't believe that anymore. I think Bohr was wrong. Because we have nanotechnology. With nanotechnology, we can manipulate individual atoms. There is no brick wall. There's no wall separating us from the atom. In fact, for BBC television, I hosted a series for them where I went to San Jose, IBM headquarters, and manipulated individual atoms.
Yeah, I saw that. That was cool.
Yeah, I had a big screen. I manipulated individual atoms. There is no brick wall. So what is the other way? The other way to resolve the Schrodinger-Cant paradox The other way to resolve it is that in one universe, the cat is dead. In the other universe, the cat is alive, and the universe has split in half. This is easily recognizable by thinking of an FM radio in your living room. Your radio is tuned to one frequency, but it coexists simultaneously with many frequencies. There's Radio Moscow, there's WABC, there's Radio Havana. All these radio frequencies simultaneously in your room, occupying the same space and time. But your FM radio has tuned into one frequency. You got that? It is out of phase. It is decohered from these other frequencies. Now, everything is a wave. That comes out of quantum mechanics. Everything's vibrating. Therefore, in your living room right now as you sit, is the wave function of dinosaurs. There are literally dinosaurs in your living room. There are space aliens. They're pirates. There's Elvis.
Arr.
In your living room. But you see, they all vibrate at different frequencies. And that's why you can't get Elvis Presley's autograph. He's not vibrating at your frequency. Your radio is tuned to one frequency. That's called reality. Your radio set is called reality, and it's only tuned to your world of today.
Yeah.
But you simultaneously exist with other frequencies. And these other frequencies represent other worlds. Now, this picture is not my picture. It comes from Steve Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize for a piece of the unified field theory. But it is Weinberg's simple analogy by which to explain the fact that cats can be dead and alive simultaneously.
But in any one universe, it's either dead or alive.
Yeah, according to many worlds theory, cats can be either dead or alive, but not both. The universe simply splits apart. And that is the easiest way to resolve time travel paradoxes.
Yeah.
In quantum mechanics, universes are for free.
Right.
They split off all the time.
But I
have to get used to this emotionally. When I look at myself in the mirror, or when you look at yourself in the mirror, most people would say, oh, what a handsome devil that guy is, right? Well, when I look at myself in the mirror, I realize that I'm not really looking at myself. First of all, I'm looking at myself a fraction of a second ago, because light takes time to go from my face to the mirror and back. Second of all, my face is a wave. It exists in all multiple states. It looks like me, but it's not really me. Parts of me are oozing off to Mars and Jupiter. This wave looks like me only because I can't see the fine-tuning of it. Parts of my wave are just oozing out throughout the entire universe. And as I walk across the room, my wave is splitting apart, walking in all sorts of different directions. Now, you may think I'm crazy, but that's how we teach quantum mechanics to our PhD students.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I don't get, isn't Schrodinger's cat, does multiple worlds actually apply to Schrodinger's cat? I mean, isn't it a macroscopic object that is decohering with the environment and kind of like observing itself? So it's not really a quantum object because it's macroscopic. So I don't understand how a macroscopic object can apply to the whole multiple worlds concept.
Well, you see, that's the Bohr interpretation, that there's a micro world and a macro world, and they obey two separate sets of physics. The new thinking is there is no macro world. It's an illusion. Everything is a micro world. Everything is a wave. Waves never collapse, as Bohr would say. That waves just continue merrily splitting off in all directions. So there is no, in some sense, there's no micro world. We're all quantum mechanical objects.
Right,
now,
right.
Of course, it's possible to take this too far. New Age people may say, well, let's talk to our dead ancestors. Let's talk to Elvis Presley.
Right.
What I'm saying is that we have decohered. We're no longer resonating in phase with them.
So you're saying
like
the universe
Radio
is...
Moscow is not resonating in phase with WABC radio in your living room. They've decohered. They're no longer vibrating in unison.
So split universes can never reconverge.
That's right. And again, the probability that they will reconverge, you'd have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe for that to happen. So you cannot rule it out. In other words, people say, well, can you rule out the fact you can talk to dead people? Well, you can't rule it out. But again, I'm not going to wait for it to happen because I would have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe for that to happen.
Right. So for all practical purposes, the universe that we're stuck in behaves like a classical universe in a way. And the because we're decohered with all the other waves that are splitting off into different universes. So it's doesn't rescue New Age magic, in other words.
Right. In other words, the universe that we see is, in fact, an illusion. It is not what we see because Photons hit the retina of her eyeball, convert electrical signals, and then go to the brain. The brain then reconstructs a mental image of our face and our body. That's what we think is, quote, objective reality, right?
Right.
The real quantum mechanics, what's really happening is that we are superpositions. We're sums of many waves existing simultaneously.
Ah, yeah.
And as we walk across the room, the most waves do look like us. By far the largest majority of these waves really do have the contours of our face, the contours of our body. But other waves merely drift off to Mars, merely drift off in all directions. Mm-hmm. But they're very small. They're very tiny in amplitude, but they do exist. Once in a while, we hit a juncture in the road, fork in the road, and then two of us emerge. And then one goes to the left, one goes to the right. But we've decohered. We can no longer interact with the other self who is married to somebody else, who got a different grade on the final exam, and he has a brother and you don't, that world has decohered from us. So in some sense, there is a world where a cosmic ray went through Hitler's mother. Hitler's mother had a miscarriage. Hitler was never born in that universe. One cosmic ray separates us from a world where World War II never happened. But we can never interact with it, or at least you'd have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe to interact with that universe.
Right. Well, Professor Kaku, I'm afraid we have to end the interview at this point. You've been extremely generous with your time. This has been fantastic. I feel like we're just scratching the surface. In fact, you know, I hope sometime in the future we can call you, maybe bring you back to talk about the things we didn't have a chance to touch upon this time.
Okay. And also go to my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org.
So thanks again for joining us, Professor Michio Kaku. It's been an extreme pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we go. Item number one, a new survey links caffeine use to hallucinations. Item number two, physicists have discovered a way to measure properties of quantum systems, such as the location of photons, without interfering with them. And item number three, NASA plans to deliver a silkworm farm to the International Space Station next month to begin an experiment using silkworms as a sustainable food source for a long space mission. Bob, please go first.
Bastard.
All right, now's the part where you start talking.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Silence is golden.
Oh, Bob.
Hang on.
Bob.
To measure property.
That's great. Bob, do what I do.
Oh, man.
Do what I do.
You're like Peter Sellers in Being There. You don't even know you're a genius.
Just read them and comment on them.
Okay, let's see. A survey links caffeine use to hallucinations. Well, I'm totally buying into that. I don't have any problem with that. I'm sure it's high caffeine use. I wonder how high, but hallucinations. Yep, I have no problem with that. Number two, this one's doesn't sound right, of course. Measuring quantum systems like light, photons of light without interfering with them. What the hell? I mean, that's just goes against so much that I've read regarding this. If you're gonna measure them, you need to interfere at some level. The location, I mean, how are you gonna know its location? But Steve, I know Steve thinks that I would just totally balk at that one and not buy it. So that alone is making me think that it's some subtle thing that they discovered. I hate that. A silkworm farm, silkworm sustainable food. I mean, oof. I'm sure they got some good protein, but they're so tiny. I mean, how could you eat it? How could you get enough? I'm going to have to go with, as much as I want the photon one, as much as I think that's not true, I think it's totally designed to fry me. I hope I don't regret this. I'm going to say the silkworms is fiction.
Okay, Evan?
I'll try to help you out here, Bob. So a new survey links caffeine use to hallucinations. So a survey? Like they just stopped people on the street and asked them and It's interesting. Usually surveys and science don't always go hand in hand.
Yeah, you'd think it would be a study, right?
Yeah, right? A study or something. So, which leads me to believe that that one is correct. And the next one is measuring properties of quantum systems without interfering with them. To tell you the truth, I thought there might have been already a way to do that. I really never gave it much thought. I'm kind of inclined to go with that one. And then the silkworm farm to the International Space Station. Yeah, it's interesting. Silkworms just, you know, first of all, there's the gross out factor initially. Ooh, worms. But I don't know. Maybe they're chock full of protein and other things that we don't know about. So, Bob, I'll help you out on this one. And I'm going to say that the measuring the properties of the quantum systems, I'll say that one is fiction.
Ah.
Okay, Jay. Yeah, I'm going to go with Evan and say that the that one's fiction as well. I can't imagine how that wouldn't be, you know, that...
It's crazy, man. It's crazy.
It's crazy talk. Okay, Rebecca. Oh, Rebecca's not with us today.
Yes, I am. Here I am. Here I am. I'll be right with you.
I'm just going to say that Rebecca would have guessed the wrong answer.
Four.
Four. Rebecca guesses four.
All right. Trick question.
Well, you all agree that a new survey links caffeine use to hallucinations is correct, and that one is indeed science.
Science. True.
And yes, this was a survey. I mean, there wasn't a controlled study. They didn't expose, like, randomized people to getting placebo or caffeine or anything. They asked people about their caffeine use and also a series of other questions, some of which included measurements of auditory and visual hallucinations. And people who drank more coffee reported more hallucinations, both auditory and visual.
Wow.
Interestingly, I think this is mainly among college-aged students. There were 200-plus participants, most of them women. And on average, they reported drinking...
Seven.
It's going to be in grams.
No, it was like they reported drinking the equivalent of about 3 cups of coffee or tea per day, which is a lot. It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
That's a lot?
That's not a lot.
Three cups of coffee is not a lot.
This is, again, also it correlates the two. It links the two. It does not establish cause and effect, again, because it wasn't a prospective or controlled study. They said it's quite possible that people who drink more coffee do other things which may give them more hallucinations. Right. For example, they may also be more likely to use street drugs or to drink alcohol or whatever.
Or people who hallucinate tend to drink more coffee.
Yeah, for whatever reason. I think that one possibility, for example, a higher percentage of people who drank more coffee reported having experiences of having left their body temporarily. Perhaps, people who drink more coffee or more caffeine have more sleep disorders and they're getting more hypnagogic hallucinations because of the sleep disorders. Because they're not sleeping as well. Because lack of sleep is definitely correlates with sleep-associated hallucinations. So that's one possible connection. So this is just establishing a link. It's the beginning of really researching this question, saying there's something here to be explored. It doesn't really answer any questions. But yes, there is a link.
Steve, I wonder what their intention was at the beginning of the survey. Did they have this idea of a link, or were they just fishing?
Yes. Yeah, no, they had an idea that there might be a link. This isn't the first suggestion that that might be the case.
Right? Okay.
So they were following up on earlier suggestions that there may be an association. The thing you have to understand is most research programs like this do 10, 12, 20 studies, you know, all nibbling around a topic or a question, looking at it from different perspectives, then you sort of develop the overall picture of what's going on. No one study really answers a lot of questions thoroughly like this. Although the one study gets the press release and gets presented and gets, you know, written about in the lay press, but it doesn't really mean that much.
Right.
It's going to take a lot more studies to know what any of this means.
And my point was that the anecdote is the very, very first step, and it's not. And people will take the anecdotes and draw conclusions when you'd have to go from the anecdote. That would be your very first tiny baby step, and then it would be there'd be a whole long line of other things you would need to do before having any firm conclusions. But they stop at the anecdotes.
Yeah. So we'll go in order, since you're split on the other two. We'll go to number two. Physicists have discovered a way to measure properties of quantum systems, such as the location of photons, without interfering with them. None of you bought that, although, Bob, you thought that I'm trying to specifically trick you. And Jay and Evan just went with their gut and decided that that one was the fiction.
I'm not going with my gut tonight.
And that one is science.
Tell me.
Yeah, I was shocked at this one.
Shocking. Were you baffled or stunned?
I was a little perplexed, actually.
Ooh,
and somewhat befuddled. And honestly, I tried to really understand what was going on here, and I don't know that I really grasp the essence of what's going on with this, because I didn't have access to the actual study, so I had to base it upon the abstract and the press release, and they were kind of dancing around the details, I suspect, because they're just a little inaccessible. But I'll give it my best shot. What this is a technique known as interaction-free measurement. And what the press release says is that for nearly a century, the widespread interpretation of quantum mechanics suggests that everything is uncertain until it is observed, and that observation inevitably alters reality. This is Professor Steinberg, who is a University of Toronto quantum physicist, and he was involved with the study. And he said, however, in the 1990s, a technique known as interaction-free measurement seemed to promise the ability to see without looking. But when Lucien Hardy proposed that one could never reliably make inferences about past events which hadn't been directly observed, a paradox emerged which suggested that whenever one attempted to reason about the past in this way, they would be led into error. So in other words, they're trying to infer the state of a quantum system, a quantum particle, without observing it and altering it. But that involves trying to infer what it was in the past. And this guy, Lucien Hardy, is saying that if you ever try to do that, you could not be led to the correct answer. So that was the Hardy paradox. And now that's what's been resolved with the new research. It says, the press release says, in essence, they combined Hardy's paradox with a new theory known as weak measurement. So now we've gone to interaction-free measurement to weak measurement. This is proposed by Tel Aviv University physicist Yakir Aharonov. And they were able to show that you can use weak measurement to learn the state of a quantum system without interfering with it. And this resolves the Hardy paradox.
I don't get it, though, because, I mean, because you've got a superposition of states before you measure it. So it's actually all of those states at once. And then when you measure it, it decoheres, right? And it picks a state. And then that's what
So this is what
they
say. The weak measurement is a tool whereby the presence of a detector is less than the level of uncertainty around what is being measured. So the interference, it's weak interference, right? And it's less than the uncertainty. So it doesn't have an impact on the uncertainty.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So it's going to take a while for me to really wrap my mind around this. I think I probably need somebody to explain it to me. But and I tried very carefully to make sure I wasn't overstating what they were talking about in the paradox. I didn't want to say, for example, without collapsing the wave function or something like that. So I'm not 100% sure that that's what they're talking about, but that seems to be what they're saying.
Okay.
You know?
Well, that Jay and I were incorrect, maybe we should put that on hold until we have all the facts.
I admit there's a certain amount of uncertainty about your incorrectness, but we're going to collapse your incorrectness as much as we can. So that was interesting.
Wow.
It's funny, I kind of wanted to talk to Michio Kaku about it, but I couldn't without ruining the science of fiction. but maybe I need to find somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
How about getting that guy from Tel Aviv University?
To deepen my understanding of that a little bit. That's interesting. Which means that, number three, NASA plans to deliver a silkworm farm to the International Space Station next month to begin an experiment using silkworms as a sustainable food for long space missions is fiction. However,
there is no International Space Station.
It is fiction. However, Chinese researchers have proposed doing just that.
Really? Wow.
Yes. They say that silkworms would be very environmentally friendly and economical. They don't take up much space. They don't poop a lot, which is apparently a big deal in space. They don't need a lot of water. And they are indeed high in proteins, including many including many essential amino acids. So they would be a good food source. Of course, in certain parts of China, silkworm pupae are eaten as a delicacy. So this would be a little bit more acceptable to them as opposed to American astronauts or European. But still, I mean, yeah, I don't know, you could do stuff with it. You could grind it up or...
Yeah, make you
know,
muffins.
Add flavoring to it, make a slurry out of it. I don't know. And this is interesting because, you know, if you think about it, fish would be very dependent upon the water conditions, which would be very difficult to maintain, and it would have to be cleaned significantly, et cetera. Chickens, you know, have feathers and poop a lot. There really isn't a great candidate for an animal species that would be convenient to raise in outer space that would be a source of protein. And they say the silkworm might be a good source. In fact, even the silk, which is itself directly inedible, could be processed in such a way as to make it edible. And you could mix it with fruit juice or something to add protein.
I'm holding out for Soylent Green.
Right. They say that each astronaut would need to consume 170 silkworm pupa and cocoons a day to fulfill their animal protein needs. That's a lot.
Yeah.
I guess you can eat it like popcorn or something.
Did he also suggest that they eat fish heads?
No. So congratulations, Bob. Your paranoia actually won out.
Yes, this time it worked.
This time the paranoia worked. Well, Evan, you're going to tell us the result of the first... Who's That Noisy episode.
Well, we got lots of guesses. All right, and for those of you who missed it last week, let's play last week's Who's That Noisy. All right.
Did anyone get it on the nose, Evan?
Nobody got it on the nose. There were several folks who made a good attempt at it and came up with... Well, let me give you the answer first, and then we'll go back and we'll figure out who was closest. So that noise, some students at Berkeley University made this wave file, and it is the sound of coughing if you were on Mars. They simulated a Martian atmosphere, coughed in it, and recorded it. And that's what it would sound like if you were coughing on Mars specifically.
Coughing on Mars.
Yep. Now, there were several people who did guess that it was coughing. Some people said it was, for instance, Sylvia Brown coughing, or hacking up a lung, as they said. And so I'll mention those folks who guessed that. There was actually two people who guessed that kind of right at the same time. From the message boards, M.D. Dawson and emailer Timmy P. emailed in to say it sounds like Sylvia Brown hacking up a lung. So I'd say that those were the two closest correct answers, but they were not exactly correct. But they did get the coughing part of it. So, and we'll put up the link for the people on the notes page for this episode so that they can go to the website and see exactly where I got that from.
Good job, Evan. And we have a new one for this week.
We do, in fact. And I'm going to cue it up right now.
Although there is nothing supernatural about it, I am willing to forfeit the sum of $1,000 to anyone who can prove that it is possible.
All right.
So obviously we have to say more than that's just some guy talking, right?
That's right.
Who it is and what is he talking about?
I want to know primarily who it is, and if you can guess what he's talking about, well, we'll consider that a bonus, but identify who the speaker is. So, good luck, everyone.
Good job, Evan. All right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes. I have a quote from Sigmund Freud. And he said, "No, our science is no illusion, but an illusion it would be to suppose that what science cannot give us, we can get elsewhere." Sigmund Freud! And that was
Herr Freud.
That was sent in by Ryan Well from Colorado. Thanks, Ryan.
That's a good quote.
I like
good one.
Very good.
That's right. Just because something cannot be figured out by science doesn't mean you could just make up your answer.
Although Lord knows people try.
Right.
They do it every day.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Shirley!
Once again, it was great to be joined with you.
And feel better, Rebecca. Hopefully she'll be joining us next week, I'm sure. It sounds like she just has a cold. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.